In 1961, the youngest son of Nelson Rockefeller, who was then the governor of New York, disappeared while he was collecting tribal art along the coast of New Guinea. Michael Rockefeller's body has never been found. Over the next 27 years, his twin sister Mary struggled with anxiety, depression, and strange aches and pains. In Beginning with the End, a memoir of twin loss and healing, Mary Morgan, now a therapist who treats bereaved twins, describes the many years she spent in denial of her grief and how she finally summoned the courage to face it. The book is published by Vantage Point, and Mary Morgan, I'm very pleased to welcome you to our show.
Thank you, Leonard. I'm happy to be here.
When was the last time you saw your twin brother?
It was on my wedding day, my first marriage.
And first of three.
First of three marriages, right. And finally have a keeper. 21 years. It was very sweet. I remember that day very well because we danced together and I said to Michael, you know, I'm doing something first getting married. And this is, I'm doing something first, and so now you'll have to follow me.
And he was going to go to New Guinea.
That's right. He was about to head off to New Guinea.
Had he done anything like that before?
No, he'd graduated from Harvard and then was in the Army. He was in the Army Reserve, so it was a short period. And then he went to be on to the highlands of New Guinea for an anthropological expedition to make the film Dead Birds, and he was the sound recording man there.
Did your father approve of the mission?
Very much so, yes.
What about you?
No.
Well, what were his reasons for approving and yours for disapproving?
Well, I think father was just a very enthusiastic person and a very had an adventurous spirit, and he knew that Michael wanted to step out of his world and to learn more about all kinds of other worlds. And
although that kind of art had been of interest to your father, there's a whole wing at Metropolitan Museum that featuring some of the things that were out of the Rockefeller collection.
Yes, that had not happened yet
at
that time. But the second part of Michael's journey to New Guinea was when he collected art along the coast of the Azmat coast, the southern coast of New Guinea. That was after the anthropological expedition. And so that's where Michael and father were so enthusiastic together about this, because Michael was on the board at the Museum of Primitive Art, which father had started, and was really very enthusiastic and sensitive and aware and very, very perceptive about what was good and what wasn't.
So the Rockefeller Wing is largely made up of stuff that Michael collected.
The Rockefeller Wing is made up of art from Africa, Oceania, and North and South America. But the Oceanic collection is, in a large part of it, is what Michael collected.
Now, what were your objections to his going?
My objections were completely personal. I had a kind of intuition that it was very dangerous and that he would not come home. So I was very frightened for him. And
so when you heard that he was missing, that felt almost like a confirmation of your worst fears?
Yes.
When did you learn that?
At my mother's house. It was shortly after my father had left my mother, and which was a big trauma in itself in our family. And he came over to the house, and we knew that something was wrong. And so we all gathered there. And he came to tell us that he'd gotten this cablegram that Michael was missing.
Michael had been riding in a boat when it capsized.
Yes.
Why did he decide to swim ashore, do we know, rather than hold on to the capsized boat as his companion Rene Wassing did?
Well, the current took this capsized boat, which was made out of two canoes, that had been attached with a platform and an outboard motor. So when that capsized and they couldn't paddle it in any way, went out way, way out to sea. They were probably 10, 12 miles out to sea by the time Michael decided to swim. And Rene Wassing really didn't swim. And Michael felt very strongly that it was the only way for them to survive because it was such a remote area, there was nobody anywhere.
But Wassing was rescued.
Yes, that's the incredible thing, because the two young guides that were on board made it to shore. They dove into the water in this huge delta where this accident happened, and immediately swam to shore and made it by going through swamps and jungles for 11 hours to the nearest missionary. Nobody thought that they would do that. And so then the missionary radioed to Hollandia, the capital of New Guinea, across the whole island, which is enormous, and they sent a plane, which then dropped supplies to René. This was 24 hours after Michael had left to swim.
You and your father flew to New Guinea to lead the search for Michael.
Yes.
What do you mean when you say that a fog surrounded you and kept you from feeling despair during the trip?
Well, that is what I describe it as a fog. It really was probably a we would say shock.
Or numbness.
And numbness. And it felt like a fog. And it really was a protective mechanism because I wasn't ready to take in the trauma of what was happening.
And then you met a woman in New Guinea who was able to touch you through the fog.
Yeah, there was a very touching event on a dock in one of the tiny villages where we went to search for Michael. And this old woman, none of the people wore clothes. It was an extraordinary thing. And so they were about as different as anything I had ever seen in my life. And yet they seemed to step out of the pages of Michael's letters. And I could see immediately how Michael had identified with these people and how they seemed to be at one with their natural surroundings. This old, old woman touched me. She held my hands and looked into my eyes and started to cry. And that was the most extraordinary thing. That stayed with me all my life as the most beautiful connecting moment for me.
Well, that was personal, and at the same time, you were contending with conducting this search with reporters from all over the world covering the story.
Yes.
Were they getting in the way?
Well, they were very horrifying in what they were saying. I must say I want to give a vote of confidence to our United States reporters, especially the New York reporters. They were really very respectful and wonderful. These guys were from all over Oceania and Asia and all over the world, and they really didn't connect personally with us, and they were interested in getting a story and making a big story that was going to be exciting and terrifying. So they asked all kinds of terrible questions.
Well, we still see it on television news sometimes. How did you feel when you found out that your brother was missing, kinds of questions? What did your mother tell you when you returned to New York and started crying?
That was the big moment. You see, when I came home, I finally was ready and felt that my mother would hold me and that we could face this together. And the first thing she said was, "You cannot cry. And we mustn't cry, Mary. We just mustn't cry. We need to hold ourselves together."
And this because you was a public family? Or?
She never gave an explanation, but my mother had lost her husband and then her youngest son all within a space of 3 weeks. So I imagine she thought if she ever started to cry, she might not stop.
Many of us remember when Governor Nelson Rockefeller's son, Michael, disappeared in 1961. But what we may have forgotten was that Michael had a twin sister, Mary, and she's written a book called Beginning with the End, a memoir of twin loss and healing, and that's what we're discussing right now. Is it surprising that the body never turned up? I would have assumed that it would have shown up on a beach somewhere at some point.
No, it did not. And there have been all kinds of stories. There still are stories about what happened to him, that he made it to shore, that he was killed by warring natives. But when you look at the tides and you look at the currents and you look at how far out he was, it seems almost impossible that he made it to shore.
Mm-hmm. But there's always that hope, and I know I've had this experience myself. After a loved one died, I'd be walking down the street and I'd see someone who looked just like her, and I'd think, was that not true? Did she not die?
Yeah, that happened to me for years. It really did. It took a long time for me to accept what happened to me. And I really needed to find the thing about twins is that their sense of identity is from the very beginning an I framed in the sense of a we. The twin bond is so enormous in the womb, coming from all the way from that experience in the womb together.
Even if they're not identical?
Even when they're not identical.
Because you had a psychiatrist, you went obviously went to a psychiatrist to deal with this, who said to you that that wasn't true.
That's right. They didn't know anything about twin. They had no twin studies, no sonograms that would begin that kind of important research. Today, they know that twins reach out to each other in the womb at 14 weeks. That's just the very beginning of the second trimester. So that that's an intentional reaching out. That's not just bumping against the side of the womb and then bumping your twin by mistake because you don't have enough room. This is really intentional reaching. So that, and when you think of the fluids that you're sharing through your mother and through the umbilical cord, all of that, the cells, the blood, all of that, twins are connected in the most extraordinary way. They actually develop in relationship. So forming a separate identity is a more challenging task for twins.
Looking back, how did Michael's death affect your marriages to your first husband, Bill, and then to Tom, your second one?
Well, I think that the most important one it affected was Tom. I think my first husband was he and I were babies when we met. We were like 2 years old, 3 years old in the little swimming pool of the club in Maine, little tiny village club that we belonged to. And so we grew up together as like friends and, became, fell in love with each other later on and had our children together, and that really bound us. But with Tom Morgan, I really felt I was looking for my twin. And that's what I think many relationships for twins are very challenging about.
And that's why the third marriage has worked, because you got past that?
I really did. First of all, I healed from this tremendous loss. I integrated the loss so that I could find and so that I could understand my twin and the relationship. I could maintain that relationship, feel the love and the support from that relationship, but actually have let go the physical life of my twin, which gets imprinted in us, and we have to let that go in order to heal. And I was able to do that before I met David, my last husband. I think that positioned me in a place where I could understand that what I was doing was searching for another twin. And so when that started coming up in our relationship, I was more aware. Also, my husband, bless his heart, wouldn't have anything to do with that. He wasn't about to become my twin.
So is this what led you to become a therapist? You were in therapy yourself?
Yes. I've always been a very, very interested in people and working with people. So I think I wanted to help people since I was a young girl. I've been involved with that kind of thing. And so this was a natural progression. I knew I had to heal before I could become a therapist,
though. And you wound up specializing in treating bereaved twins.
Yes, that happened as a result of 9/11, where I worked with the twins and the Trade Center disaster. And that's when I decided to write the book. Because I understood that they wanted so much for people to know about twins and twin loss.
How many twins were lost on September 11th?
46.
Wow.
In the whole disaster.
Yeah,
you know,
still,
including
that's a lot.
The Pentagon and the planes. It was actually statistically about right. But since then, many, many more twins have been born in vitro, fertility drugs, and also the fact that women have twins at the last part of their reproductive cycle, and women are having babies later and later now.
What do you mean when you say you've moved forward from Michael's death but not moved on?
Yes, moving on really relates to how we look at death in this culture. The fact that we're given such little time to grieve, and then we have to pick ourselves up and move on with our lives, literally. That is kind of the American way of doing. We're doers as a culture.
But we insist on closure.
Well, we do, but we don't. But the interesting is, we don't make closure. What we really do is repress the grief, and it goes deeply buried. Moving forward means doing our therapeutic work to grieve, the act of bereavement, and then moving forward in our life with the sense of our twinship or our loved one, knowing that they're there to support us and love us, but actually being comfortable in finding meaning in our life as an individual.
We have very little time left, but I was wondering, were you concerned about writing such an intimate book about a family whose lives have already been made quite public over the years? Is it possible for a family like yours to maintain a sense of privacy?
You got 30 seconds. Okay, it's a good question. It took me 5.5 years to write this book and to come to terms with sharing my personal life. I try to share my life and not other people's lives in a way that would ever hurt anybody. So I wanted to be there to help other people with this book, and that's why I thought it was worth sharing my personal story.
Mary R. Morgan's book is called Beginning with the End, A Memoir of Twin Loss and Healing. It is published by Vantage Point, and I want to thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you very much, Leonard. I was really honored to be here.